After the Flood, Holding the Heartache, and Confronting the Policy. From SDPB, today is Wednesday, June 26th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, journalists Seth Tupper and Kevin Wooster are with us. We'll look at the flood mitigation plan for McCook Lake and what some residents are saying about the governor's response. That's our Dakota Political Junkies conversation today. We'll explore the Logan family legacy in Mitchell as a movie theater transitions to new ownership. That's coming after the news. Plus, South Dakota One Book author Trent Presler kicks off his tour of the state in the SDPB studios. We'll bring you highlights from the conversation about Little and Often. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting live today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. For more than 90 years, a local Mitchell family owned and operated Logan Luxury 5 Theaters. Nelson Logan built the original theater in 1933 and ran the operation for decades before passing it on to his son, Jeff Logan. Last month, Jeff retired. Ownership has now passed to a Minnesota-based chain, but Jeff Logan is with us now on the phone to talk about his family's cinematic legacy in Mitchell. Mr. Logan, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you.
All the kids from Mitchell call you Mr. Logan, so that's...
Yeah, call me Jeff, please.
Because you have been part of so many people's childhoods as they grew up in the movies and going to the theater and knowing that you owned it, but you also started out as a young person in the theater. You started hanging out there when you were like 9 years old, as I understand it. Tell me a little bit about some of those early days.
That's right. My dad had built the theater in 1933, leased it in 1949 for 10 years until 59, at which time he wouldn't renew the lease with the people he had leased it to because he felt he had let the theater run down and he wasn't happy with the operation. So he took it back when the lease was up, totally gutted the theater for 4 months, rebuilt it, re-equipped it, and got back into the business. So I was 9 years old at that time. And, you know, in a family business, kind of like a family farm, everyone pitches in. So at an early age, some of my first jobs that I recall were delivering posters to stores around town. We had 14 locations in the downtown area of hotels, restaurants, retail stores, and so forth, where we had what were called window cards. And I would take them around, and then I would also help sweep up after kiddie matinees. And then as I grew older, I learned more positions and would sell candy and take tickets, eventually learned to run the projectors and write the newspaper ads and all the things that we had to do. So it was a fun growing up and, you know, great for a young guy. Mm-hmm. At night, you're there, and all the high school girls who are cashiers and concession in those days called candy girls, which seems a little politically incorrect today, but that was a term in those days. And it was a great, great place to grow up.
Yeah. So did you have to watch your friends come in with their dates on a Friday night while you were working at the theater? How did you handle the social aspect when you were a teenager, maybe, of being the guy behind the counter?
That wasn't a problem as much. It was just fun to see them.
Yeah.
The bigger problem was if I took a girl on a date, I didn't want to bring her to our theater. There would be too much talk and under the watchful eyes of my folks. So we would do something else, or we would go to the opposition theater, the other theater in town that was at that time owned by a national chain. So that was the clumsiest part.
Or
go to the drive-in theater, which is a whole other story.
That's a whole other story that we'll maybe leave for, yeah. So when did you decide that, you know, this was what you wanted to do as an adult, that had value for you to be the guy who kept the movies running in Mitchell?
Well, I always enjoyed the business. And I think as I grew older, the part that really I liked the best was writing the ads and seeing the results opening night, if your campaign worked and if good crowds showed up and all that. So I went to college and went the first year to Dakota Wesleyan, transferred to University of South Dakota. And at USD, I changed my major to advertising. And I quickly realized that to get a good job in advertising, I'm going to have to work for an agency, going to have to move to a city, probably really New York is where a lot of the big work was being done. And then I would write ads for, a dish detergent or something.
Yeah.
And that didn't sound real thrilling. So I was also taking courses in broadcast journalism. And I had worked also at the local radio station, KORN in Mitchell, my freshman year at Wesleyan. I was a part-time nighttime disc jockey. And so I enjoyed that. I wound up getting a key position at KUSD television, anchoring the news there on television. Mm-hmm. And so I thought of doing that, but then I realized I've always been now blessed by looking younger than I am. But when you're 21, 22 years old and you look 17, it was a disadvantage. And I realized I would never get a good paying job at a major station for a lot of years. And so if I'm going to be a reporter and working nights and weekends chasing sirens, I might as well go back home and work nights and weekends at the theater. And then a couple of things precipitated that decision. One was my father's health. He was obviously older when I was born, so his health was failing. And so I was kind of pushed on the decision, it's either go back now or we sell the theater. And then I, with the age thing, I realized, I just wouldn't get a job. So I went back.
Yeah.
And it was during that time, too, that it kind of firmed up the decision. I was filling in projecting one night. This is back in the days before automation. And you're doing 20-minute reels, two projectors, changeovers, and carbon arc lamp houses, all of which required a lot of immediate attention. And we were playing MASH, the movie MASH, mm-hmm. that came out long before the television series. And the audience, it was full house, the audience was laughing so hard that it was actually rattling the glass in the portholes, in the glass windows. And I thought, boy, if you can make that many people laugh that hard, this is a pretty cool business.
Yeah.
So one thing and another, I left college and moved back and took over the theater. And it was shortly after that that we got the opportunity to buy the opposition theater from the national chain.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a big deal, and that that was really the kickoff of growing, our one family theater that my dad had built.
Mm. What is the, with so much, and technology has changed with streaming and whatnot, what do you think as you look to the future or even the past, 3 or 4 years for you post-pandemic, what do you think it means for a town in South Dakota to have a local theater where people can gather and have those glass-shattering moments of laughter or that community connection? Why keep theaters open in smaller towns in a place like South Dakota?
Well, I think theaters are really a community center, and because different movies appeal to different segments of the audience, during the course of a year or a month, everyone goes to the theater at one time or other, whether you're playing a picture geared for the younger crowd or for the senior crowd or whomever and whatever interest. And that's also, I love the variety of seeing everyone from every walk of life and mm-hmm. age group and income strata and everything else. That it's a real meeting place. Everyone comes together. And it also contributes to the economic life. A theater in the town is a quality of life issue for that town. We have a theater. If you don't even have a movie theater, gee, what do you do in town for recreation? You know, all there is maybe a high school ball game. So a theater adds a lot, and there are also a lot of studies that have proven the economic benefit to restaurants, gas stations, bars, even retail shopping, that people come to town and you don't just go to a movie, you spend money on other things. So theaters, I think, are very important. The problem in South Dakota with the smaller towns, you really need anywhere from 7,000 to 10,000 population to support each screen in a town. Mm. So if you have a single screen theater, yeah, a town of 5,000, 7,000, 10,000, you can do it. As you get larger, you need more screens, and which also is required because of contracts. You have to play a movie for a minimum of 2 or 3 weeks when you get it on the national break.
Sure.
So theaters are very important to a town, and some of the smaller towns, I think that's testified by the fact that they've kept their theater open by setting up a nonprofit volunteer. So they have volunteer labor. I know one town who even helped the theater get started there. The theater building is owned by the city, and they don't charge the theater committee, who's appointed by the mayor, they don't charge them their share of the taxes or the insurance or any of those expenses. The city takes care of roof repairs and everything else, volunteer labor, and city-controlled utilities they send over. And they keep it going because they want it for the town. So the theater has almost none of the overhead of a normal theater, but that's how some of the smaller towns can keep a local nonprofit, volunteer-based theater going.
Yeah.
Towns like Mitchell and so forth that are a little larger, you can afford to have private ownership, maybe pay a manager, still get a return on investment. And so theaters are important to the lifeblood of a town, any town of any size.
Well, I know that you're retiring, but I hope that you will still continue to come and talk to us about things like the Oscars and big movie events in the future, because I'm sure you're still interested in film and the impact it has on us culturally. Jeff Logan, thank you so much. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Listening to In the Moment on SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. As floodwaters slowly begin to recede in eastern South Dakota, our Dakota political junkies are joining us from west of the river. They're bringing some analysis into the state's flood response. Seth Tupper is editor-in-chief of South Dakota Searchlight. We also have journalist Kevin Wooster with us, and they are both seated in SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. Kevin Wooster, welcome. Thanks so much for being here.
Hey, Laura. It's good to be back. Always.
Always. Seth Tupper, thanks for being here as well.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Always nice to have you here. All right, let's talk about McCook Lake. And for people across the state who aren't quite sure how the rivers intersect here and what happened in the southeast corner of the state, Seth, set us up with the devastation, really, which is unprecedented for many of these homeowners.
Well, yeah, to make a really long story short, as everybody knows by now, you know, in southeastern South Dakota last week, up to 15 or more inches of rain fell in some areas. All of that rain collected in a few, you know, in some rivers and creeks that run down to the Missouri River in the southeast corner of the state, including the Big Sioux. And Sunday night, the Big Sioux hit a record crest as it was coming down toward McCook Lake, Dakota Dunes, and North Sioux City, which are all kind of clustered together down there in the southeast corner of the state. And, you know, the local authorities and state and federal authorities enacted a longstanding plan they've had to basically plug an interstate exit there and put in a temporary levee across Interstate 29 that to complete a system of permanent levees that diverts water away from North Sioux City and Dakota Dunes toward McCook Lake. And but they had never done that with as much water coming down the Big Sioux as was this time. And McCook Lake was just absolutely devastated. Houses along the northern shore of McCook Lake were completely wiped out. We've heard reports of anywhere from a dozen to a couple dozen homes, you know, basically ruined, gone, other homes flooded. People were running out of that area for their lives on Sunday night, and there were rescues happening. So really, really chaotic scene there Sunday night.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the governor's role and the emergency response. What some Cook Lake residents are having to say. Tell us a little bit about your reporting in South Dakota Searchlight.
Well, my perspective on this really informed by watching the governor's press conference on Sunday. On Sunday, she was in North Sioux City, and she held a press conference that she streamed live on Facebook, and it was on local TV in Sioux City, and it lasted about 45 minutes, and she and some folks from the Army Corps of Engineers and from the State Department of Transportation and local emergency manager and others spoke at length about what they were doing to prepare for the flood and what people should be doing. They mentioned that Dakota Dunes had issued a voluntary evacuation order. They talked at length about that and about building the levee that I just spoke about. But, you know, in hindsight, nobody said really anything urgent about McCook Lake or said anything to the effect that, you know, if you're in McCook Lake, you might want to think about getting out or diverting water your way. There was no explicit warning whatsoever given to the people of McCook Lake. In fact, as I reported today in our story, you know, Governor Noem made some comments that, well, you know, somebody asked at the press conference, what should people at McCook Lake be doing? And she said, you know, they should be protecting their property and maybe they'll see some water, maybe they won't, but they might. And that was about it. And then, of course, you know, what they saw was an absolutely catastrophic situation just hours later.
So what happened? In the sense that did she have bad information? I mean, you have that word should in there. You should be protecting your personal property, which is a lot different from saying evacuate now. This is dangerous. I need you to get out. How quickly did the information that the governor had at her fingertips change? What do you know?
Well, it did change fast. And what happened, obviously, you know, was a disaster. And, of course, yeah. You know, we'll say that up front. Hindsight's 20/20. But, you know, the information was changing so rapidly. When she gave her press conference, she quoted a projection about when the Big Sioux River would crest and when. And after the press conference ended, I just went to the website where you can find river crest information from the National Weather Service to verify what she had said. Yeah. And the forecast was completely different, you know, within 20 minutes after she had gotten done speaking. So, yes, the you know, conditions changed very rapidly. It was the Big Sioux River ended up cresting 7 feet over where it had ever crested before. So, you know, I guess authorities have that on their side to say, you know, look, nobody could have predicted this. But on the other hand, they already knew when they were speaking Sunday, according to their, you know, rapidly outdated projections, that the Big Sioux River was going to hit a record crest. And yeah. They knew that they were diverting that water toward McCook Lake. And they didn't really give a stern warning to the people of McCook Lake about those two facts that they knew
at that time. Kevin Wooster, tell us a little bit about, you know, a governor having a press conference, emergency management. There are lots of layers to this. It's easy to armchair quarterback this thing, but there are certain things that we know about how these emergencies need to be communicated to people. Are you seeing anything here that is particularly worth surfacing for people today?
Well, for one thing, I think we might as well get used to this and prepare for this, because this is, I would think, these kind of natural disasters are going to settle the question in some people's mind on whether climate change is real and having an impact on it, our lifestyle here. Secondly, I had to think, I know Governor Noem, she takes information from the experts, and she does the best she can with that. But I think Seth has laid out why maybe it could have been handled a little better. The warnings could have been a little better. And I also think about the guy that we remember as Mr. Disaster Response in Bill Janklow, who was often accused of being over the top, of doing too much, of predicting horrible things that didn't happen, and always being too involved in things. And I think Governor Noem leaves herself open to some criticism because of her schedule. Some of it was just the way it worked out, unfortunately for her, that she was in D.C. for Meet the Press, and then back the Southeast South Dakota on Sunday, and then back, as I understand it, to Memphis on Sunday night for a political event there. And you have to just kind of believe, knowing the way Bill Janklow operated, that whatever obligations he would have had, he would have canceled elsewhere. And you couldn't have got him away from that disaster scene he'd probably still be down there now. He certainly would have been there all weekend. And it's easy to say she should have done it the way Janklow did it. And, you know, she did what she could do. But I think she left herself open to a lot of second guessing on her schedule. Mm.
So we're a little short on time today, so I want to circle back to something that Kevin said there. But I want to refer listeners to South Dakota Searchlight's reporting, because Seth really does go through in the most recent piece, you know, what time the emergency responders were going door to door, when the notifications went out on Facebook and cell phones. So I don't want to leave people with the impression that, you know, nobody was warned at any point. And the timeline is really in that piece. But in the interest of our time today on live radio, Seth, what Kevin was saying about getting used to it gets at, getting used to the fact that this is not going to be the last flooding that we have that is unprecedented. There are homeowners here who are saying this mitigation plan needs to be reevaluated. So my question to you is, Seth, what happens next when we think about, because the mitigation plan was in place, it's designed to protect critical infrastructure downstream, but the McCook Lake residents say, you know, this is pretty devastating to us. We need to talk about this plan in the future. What do you want to highlight there?
Well, and that's an opportunity maybe for Governor Noem to step in, and I hope she does, and maybe lead and encourage and facilitate a reevaluation of how floodwaters are handled down there and what the plan is. As far as I was told, this plan dates to the 1970s, and when you think about all the development, for example, in Sioux Falls that has happened since then, and land that has been converted to asphalt, and all the cropland, all the grassland that's been converted to cropland in southeast South Dakota, and climate change, and all the different variables to take into account now that didn't exist back in the 1970s, it does seem like that plan is long overdue for a look. And, you know, obviously, if people are going to continue to live around McCook Lake, they're going to be in harm's way if this plan stays the way it is now. So there is an opportunity for somebody to step in and lead there and take a good hard look at that.
Yeah. The DNR says that water would have ended up in McCook Lake regardless. It was a pretty extreme event. So to that point, we all need to be thinking about the future and what's going to happen as well. Any final thoughts, Kevin, that you want to leave us with today?
Well, my first thought was, Seth said, if people are going to live around McCook Lake, is that the kind of thing we're going to be considering? Is this kind of a harbinger of what we could be looking at in the future? Should we have people living around McCook Lake? Is that a wise thing long term? Are things going to change enough that they'll get hit again with something like this in 5 or 10 or 15 or 20 years?
So many questions worth exploring here, and it's all part of how state government interacts with the people in the state and that communication. And I refer you to South Dakota Searchlight. Seth Tupper is editor-in-chief. Seth, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Kevin Wooster, Perspective, always welcome as well. Thank you.
Good to be here.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The South Dakota Humanities Council has selected Trent Presler's Little and Often as the 2024 South Dakota One Book. This week, the author tours the state, and we kicked off that tour in the SDPB Sioux Falls studios last night. The book is Presler's memoir about growing up in rural South Dakota and how the death of his rodeo champion father served as the catalyst for a monumental life change. An audience gathered in the Leo P. Flynn Gallery. Here is the beginning of our conversation with Trent Presler. Let's start with Little and Often. For
sure.
People who are new to the book, this is the spot where your life tries to bridge your upbringing in faith, the farm crisis, your father's Vietnam service, mm-hmm. your life in Yankton, and then moving to New York.
Yeah.
And early on, it's evident in the book that you say it's hard for you to find acceptance in either place.
Yeah.
Let's start there.
Should we dive right in?
Yes.
Let's dive
right into that.
Wow. Okay. Just rip the Band-Aid off. you know, I think for a lot of, a large part of my life, I felt like I straddled two worlds. And maybe it's too simple to just say two worlds because it's all one country. But I think many people probably who read the book or people in South Dakota can relate to the rural life and growing up on a farm or a ranch, and then coming out as gay, and then moving to New York City and working for a movie mogul, and having this sort of whiplash experience of my life, and that sort of constant tension and pulling back and forth of who am I and where do I belong and where's my tribe. And a big part of feeling, I guess, worthy in this world somehow is feeling like you have a tribe of other people who get you and support you and kind of want to lift you up. And for better or for worse, you'd like to be just a strong, independent man on your own. But I've always struggled with, well, if I go there, you know, back to the country, am I too gay for the country? Or in New York City, am I the only person in this cocktail party talking about cattle ranching? You know, like, no one cares, right? And so I would kind of find myself lost in that world, at least emotionally. Yeah. And the book plops us right down there, I think, I hope.
Yes. And people, what is the experience like to be at a party or to be at work and just bring up something casually that to you or to this audience might make perfect sense, but yeah. to the audience that you're in front of, everybody does that double take to say, are you making that up? Are you your father with a bullwhip and a rattlesnake? Right. Like, you must be making that up. What were some of those moments like with you? How do they feel?
Yeah, well, you know, there's always the talk of flyover country. And which is the sort of cast off notion that I found on the East Coast, where if you were from one of those places in the middle that people hadn't been to, that it was almost like the butt of a joke. Oh, I've never met anyone from there, but who has, right? Mm-hmm. Well, actually, a lot of people have, in fact. And the paradox of that is that I think, and I can say this now having been a New Yorker for more than two decades, is that a lot of people who live there might think, well, this is the center of the world, right? And if you're in, you make it in New York, you can make it anywhere, and it's skyscrapers and Broadway and Showtime. But there's a closed-mindedness there that it is the center of everything and that nothing else kind of around it matters. I grew up always feeling like, what's at the end of the road? Like, how can I get out? And I had this full circle moment last semester. I was teaching students at Cornell, and I had this amazing student from the Bronx. And he was in my office saying how he grew up and he just couldn't wait to get out. And I said, you grew up in New York City. And he said, I just wanted to always get out and see what was at the end of the road. And I was like, wow, okay. This is a shared experience, I think, among everyone, wherever we start from. Somehow we have like an aspirational tug, like where are we going to get to next? I don't know if that answered your question at all, but
And it's television, it's movies. Tell me a little bit about growing up on the ranch, some of the cultural touch points that let you realize there was a world outside of South Dakota, outside of your family and faith tradition.
Well, the Muppets Take Manhattan. I mean, look, it's the first movie I saw. We went on my birthday. I think it was my eighth or tenth birthday. Anyway, I had to take a nap because we had to drive to the movie theater, and it was a thing, right? But there I was, and I'd never really seen images of New York City before, and there's Kermit the Frog and skyscrapers, and wow, there's a whole world out there. And I don't know if we have those types of shared experiences so much anymore because media is so all-consuming and we're just bombarded with all kinds of shows and images and things to watch online. But at least back then, for me, that was a real crystallizing moment that, well, Kermit and all of his little fuzzy friends wanted to move to New York, and so I can too. But,
yeah. Well, we drove to town because we lived in rural Northwest Iowa when I was small, and we'd drive to Sioux Falls, and then we would do whatever we needed to do in Sioux Falls, and then the car ride back, we would sit in the back seat or the front seat or wherever we were back then, I suppose, no seat belts, and we would like name the fast food restaurants that we drove by because we wanted, you know, so we'd be like, oh, McDonald's, Burger King, and my dad was not stopping that car. Like, there was no way we were going to get McDonald's, but that coming to town and seeing something that seems so comical right now, but we were so excited about McDonald's.
Right, Right.
We were so excited. And then we would get the French fries and we would like lick the ketchup off and like dip it again in ketchup and lick it off because we want to finish the fries. That was the distance that you had to travel to get to something that other people took for granted leaves an impression on you is what I'm trying to say. It certainly left an impression on you.
Well, and you know, the distance doesn't even have to be far.
Yeah.
I mean, you went from Northwest Iowa to Sioux Falls to have fast food, right? And it affected you profoundly, and it's something you remember to this day. Those distances, I think, sometimes feel farther emotionally than they might be physically.
Because
There's always an othering, somehow, of what other people have or what support they have in society or who they are and what you're not. At least as a child, I think, that can be an easy comparison and an easy road to go down.
Yeah.
And I mean, thank God I grew up before the internet because I don't know, for better or worse, where I would be.
Tell me about your faith tradition in the sense that as a young person, what were you thinking about God? What were you thinking about the church of your childhood that you would end up interrogating more as an adult? But what were some of the first impressions and memories that you have of spirituality?
Well, church was a weekly routine, and the singing and the song part of it became profound for me. There was one crystallizing moment when my sister was still alive, and she was kind of coming in and out of coherence, I would say, and we went to church one Sunday, and she suddenly belted out a line from a song. I think it was the Common Doxology, and and those are sounds and images that are hard to shake. They're kind of I hear a Lutheran hymn, and my head turns on a swivel, right? But also, I started to question early on, you know, if God is supposedly so great, then how does He allow people like my sister to have these horrible disabilities, or how is there so much suffering in the world, or how can I be a little gay kid and told that actually, just kidding, this isn't for you, and you have to now burn in hell, and none of that fit. Those puzzle pieces didn't fit, and even like the young Earth theory stuff of I remember we had to make a paper mache Noah's Ark in summer Bible camp. You know, and the young scientist in me was like, well, okay, the ark, the flood, all right, sure. And I was told that the reason there are dinosaur fossils is because those were the ones that couldn't, they were too big to fit on the ark during the flood, so they died, right? But no, but that's like a serious belief, a belief structure, right? And I think any faith that you grew up in, especially as a child, you do see it as infallible because it's kind of all you know. So I started to explore most of those things, and I remember getting to college at Iowa State, and first day of biology 101, the professor starts talking about evolution. You know, and it's the first time in my life that I've heard that evolution is like legitimate and it's based on science and it is a thing, right? And that everything wasn't just created with a wave of a magic wand precisely 2,024 years ago. So these are journeys that I've been on and roads that I've traveled all through my adult life. And I wouldn't say that it gets any easier as you get older. I think if anything, part of me sometimes almost wishes that the world were still that simple. You know, like, oh, if there were just a perfect answer for everything, black and white, how comforting that would be.
Speaking of infallible, your father is larger than life. Champion rodeo cowboy, tough as nails, Vietnam veteran. You unpack a box after his death that reveals part of his military story that you and your mother had no idea existed. Tell us about that moment for you.
Well, we came home from his funeral. We were at the dining table in Yankton with mom and my aunt and uncle. And we opened this basically a taped shoebox in the basement and found a Bronze Star from Vietnam and some other photos and just things that we hadn't known about or uncovered or talked about until then. You think about living a life and then at the end of it, the things that are left. I think about this sometimes now when I look at my dirty garage. And I'm like, if I die today, the lawnmower is over there, and there's a wheel off the wagon, and everything's a mess. But it really crystallized for me when Dad died, and we found the Bronze Star, and then my mom gave me some of his tools, and then he had this taxidermy duck that I took as well. And, you know, you're kind of left holding it as like, well, this is it. You know, these are the physical remembrances that I have. But he was a larger-than-life figure for me, and he became even larger once I realized that there was a sort of decorated war hero part to his past. And I remembered asking my aunt at the time why he never talked about it. Why didn't we know he had a Bronze Star? And she said that she wondered if maybe it was just that he wasn't proud of what he did to earn it. You know, which is to kill people, right? In war, you kill people. So he killed people probably in some heroic situation and got a Bronze Star. And that's the reality of war. We'll never know, and we don't hear those stories. There's so much trauma to unpack already, but we can imagine them. And he was a good marksman, so.
My father used to say, Lori, there are some questions you just don't ask people.
Yeah, sure.
I showed him by becoming the person who asks all the questions. But that's how he would address those kinds of questions. Yeah. He would just say, there's some questions you don't ask. Not, I don't want to answer. Not, right. You know, none of your business that you don't ask those questions. Right. I do not want to be.
Right.
That's the legacy, you know. When I think of your book and the legacy of the farm crisis, because your family will lose this lifestyle. And your father, who's incredibly... I don't know that I would use the word proud, but incredibly, his identity is wrapped up in all these things that he does. Now he has to move to town in this sort of crummy apartment that is just not a good fit for your family.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit, this is bringing up something
for
you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just got goosebumps. Because you think about our life, even though we were quite poor, our life was expansive. We had thousands, I think almost 10,000 acres of land. And it was half desert, you know, and this is like grass growing, this scrubby grass that the cows would chew on and try to get some nutrients out of. But, you know, and then we moved to Yankton and lived in a small one-bedroom apartment, and Dad worked at a factory as a welder. And it felt like the great shrinking of our life. Like suddenly, you know, instead of after school getting on a horse and riding until sunset, it would be... you know, walking home from school to this one-bedroom apartment and maybe stopping and watching the kids play tennis on the way home and a chain-link fence with weeds growing out of the cracks. Like, everything condensed, like popping a balloon. And I can never know or, you know, I guess it's maybe the question I didn't ask and don't need to ask, but I, you know, I don't really grasp how that affected my father, but I could imagine that his pride in being... his whole life, he was in the rodeo and riding horses and getting bucked off and doing dangerous things that it might have been a real domesticated turn of events.
That's just the start of our conversation with Trent Presler, recorded live last night in the SDPB studios in Sioux Falls. Presler is the author of Little and Often. That book was selected as the 2024 South Dakota One Book. You can find our full conversation online at sdpb.org/news. The tour, by the way, continues through July 2nd. Tonight, Trent Presler is in Howard, South Dakota. Tomorrow, in Milbank and Aberdeen. And you can find his full schedule of stops online at sdhumanities.org.